There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Welcome to ModPath Chat, the official podcast of Modern Pathology, featuring interviews with authors and experts on the latest science, technology, and developments in the field of pathology. Your host, Dr. George Netto, is the editor-in-chief of Modern Pathology and the chair of pathology at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. Here's Dr. Netto.
Welcome to another exciting episode of ModPath Chat. It gives me a great pleasure to have Dr. Marissa Nucci as our guest today to discuss her team's study on atypical uterine polyps that was recently published in Modern Pathology. Dr. Nucci is a professor of pathology at Harvard Medical School and vice chair and director of the Division of Women Health and Perinatal Pathology at Brigham and Women. Marissa is a superstar in our field, and I mean it when I say that. She is the past president of the Arthur Purdy Stout Society, president-elect of the International Society of Gynecologic Pathology, and has earned many, many awards. She is a co-editor of three major gynecologic pathology textbooks. So thank you, Dr. Nucci, for joining me today.
George, thank you so much. It's really a pleasure to be here with you today.
Thank you. So I love those podcasts if for no other reason is because they make me learn so much about stuff that I usually would not scrutinize in so much detail. And this study, it's really, I want to preface it, it's exemplary on how a great study in morphology, in molecular, in clinical is done. And it's really, I recommend for people who are new writing manuscripts to look at how this study was done because I congratulate you on it. So I realize it's a rare, relatively rare entity for you to have 63 cases and you're very busy practice, but it seems like it can pose a major issue in terms of management and when we face such a lesion, correct? So can you give us a little background?
Yeah, that's correct. And I'd just like to say that this paper was really spearheaded by my former fellow, Dr. David Chapel, who's currently on staff at University of Michigan. So he really was a tremendous help in getting this paper published. This is a practical problem that gynecologic pathologists deal with on a daily basis. Endometrial polyps are actually quite common, that you see them quite often in your daily practice. Right. And I remember when I was in training, it was always said, it's not a question of if you'll miss an adenosarcoma, it was when. Mm-hmm. And so there was always this thought of when you're looking at polyps, always be very careful that you're not looking or missing an adenosarcoma. So there's a practical problem on a daily basis with regard to this diagnosis. But on the other hand, a diagnosis of adenosarcoma has a tremendous impact on the patient. If you make the diagnosis of adenosarcoma, the patient typically will go ahead and get a hysterectomy and a bilateral salpingo-oophorectomy. And although the adenosarcomas typically occur in a slightly older age population, it can occur in reproductive age women, and it can have a big impact on their life. And so we're very interested in this threshold issue with regard to making the diagnosis. And over the course of many years, we've seen cases that raise the possibility of this diagnosis, but mm-hmm. don't quite meet the threshold. And the purpose of this study was really to expand upon a prior study that we did with Dr. Howitt, Burke Howitt, who's out at Stanford, looking at just clinical outcome of these polyps that didn't cross the threshold for adenosarcoma. So really, the point of this study was to expand upon the number of cases that we had, and we doubled the number of cases and also looked at the clinical outcome, but then also asked the question, you know, how do these relate molecularly to benign endometrial polyps and to what we now know about the molecular biology or the molecular genetics of adenosarcoma?
Excellent. And you already mentioned two co-authors, and we should mention Lynette Scholl and Paula Delchin, who really contributed majorly to this study. So let's move on then to talk about what were the techniques, what was the study design. I know you studied, we mentioned 63 polyps from 58 patients or 58 women, So what kind of technology you used, just briefly, and what were your major findings?
Yeah, so we obtained the material from our files and from our in-house files and our consultation files for any patient that was diagnosed with one of these atypical polyps.
And can you just mention briefly the morphologic features?
Yeah, so I mean, I think, you know, most people know the diagnostic criteria for adenosarcomas, which is really well-developed phalloidiform architecture, hypercellular cuffing of the epithelium by cellular stroma, stromal cell atypia, which may or may not mm-hmm. be present, and mitotic activity. And these really have to be kind of very well-developed features. And I know that anyone who's looked at endometrial polyps will know that you'll come across polyps that might have a slight vague phalloidiform mm-hmm. architecture, or you might see some vague, rare hypercellular stroma, but it makes you think about it, but it's not something where you look at it and you say, well, this is an adenosarcoma. It just raises concern. And I realize here there's a morphologic continuum and threshold issues with regard to diagnosis, but when I typically lecture about adenosarcoma, I say, you know, you really have to make sure that it is a bona fide, well-developed one before you make that diagnosis. And if there's only partial involvement of a polyp or the features aren't well-developed, you should really be cautious. And that's really what these polyps are. They're the ones that's that really don't cross the threshold for the diagnosis of adenosarcoma. And I think one of the powerful things about this study and the study that we had before is that because we didn't, you know, we weren't diagnosing these as malignant. Many of these patients were just followed, obviously, mm-hmm. clinically. And we had, fantastic follow-up. 80% of our patients had follow-up, either clinical or on sampling. And most of the sampling was actually curettings, not necessarily hysterectomy. And so you could really understand the biology of the disease, because if you make the diagnosis of an adenosarcoma that doesn't have sarcomatous overgrowth or myometrial invasion, most patients do well. So if you have a hysterectomy, you may have interrupted the biologic, you know, mm-hmm. continuum or potential of these lesions. So to have follow-up that wasn't a hysterectomy, I think really tells you what the natural biology of these lesions are. So that was the clinical, you know, follow-up mm-hmm. part of the study. And then the other part of the study was to really look at a subset of these molecularly. And we used our next generation sequencing platform termed OncoPanel to look at that.
And there's some fish.
And so what we found was, you know, from the clinical pathologic perspective, none of these patients developed an adenosarcoma. And a small subset, about 10%, had recurrent polyp, sometimes benign polyp or a polyp that had these atypical features. But none of them developed what we would classify as an adenosarcoma with, on follow-up sampling. So I think with this larger clinical pathologic series, what we're really saying is these things don't act in an aggressive way. They act in a benign clinical, with a benign clinical outcome. So again, it's important to understand that you have to kind of reach that threshold for adenosarcoma to really have, to really identify lesions that'll have an impact on the patient. And then go ahead.
If I may say, so just to highlight for our audience, so the follow-up is extensive, like you said, over 12 years as median and on many of them. But nevertheless, there were like almost a quarter of the patients had undergone hysterectomy. So that's something to keep in mind, that people may overreact to your diagnosis, and you have to be very careful and qualified.
And patients too, of course, you know, some patients don't like uncertainty, right? Mm-hmm. And so if you write a report saying, here's a polyp, it's got a, you know, atypical features, but, you know, in our experience, this doesn't represent an adenosarcoma. They may decide, well, I don't really want to take the risk if, you know, there is any uncertainty. And the second part is some of these patients are having bleeding or clinical symptoms and they want to have a hysterectomy anyway. So I think there is that side of it that it may lead to hysterectomy anyway, based on patient, you know, desires and symptoms. But then again, you know, we have, you know, a large cohort of the patients that didn't have that.
So the molecular, so some intriguing molecular findings you found. So
yeah, the molecular findings are really interesting because, and I think just, you know, we can get into the nitty gritty of the findings, but just from a 20,000 foot level, I think what's interesting is that these funny polyps have molecular overlap with adenosarcoma as well. Mm-hmm. Right. They don't have as many of the changes as adenosarcoma, and they have a lower tumor mutational burden, lower copy number variants, but they do share some of the same changes that you see in adenosarcoma. And what this kind of suggests is that not only do they morphologically share some of the features of adenosarcoma, but they molecularly share. And so they may very well be the very earliest forms, or at least on the biologic spectrum, of adenosarcoma. Now, I don't think we should call them adenosarcomas because of their benign outcome, and they don't really fulfill the morphologic criteria. But it kind of gets back to this whole interesting thing about how we as pathologists like to put things into categories mm-hmm. and bins. But biologically, things are along a spectrum.
Always a continuum.
It's always a continuum. And I think this is a nice example of that, you know, highlighting the biologic continuum between these funny looking polyps and adenosarcoma. And interestingly, we didn't look at benign polyps. In other words, we didn't do next generation sequencing on benign polyps, which actually would be very interesting. The data that we cite and we know about is based on cytogenetic literature, with benign polyps typically having rearrangements of 6P21, which has the HMGA1 locus and things like that. So one would argue that benign polyps are a different pathobiological process than these polyps, which might be on the biological continuum of adenosarcoma. But I think that more work needs to be done in this area to really, really clarify that.
Excellent. So you mentioned MMGA2, and I think MDM2 is the other gene that you found some overexpressions, and these are genes involved in lipogenesis, I guess, most commonly.
Yeah, it's very interesting. So, I mean, the HMGA2 gene and the MDM2 gene, which are very close together, so if they're amplified or often amplified together, they're close together in location. So these polyps had amplification, which is unusual for HMGA2, which is unusual for benign polyps. I think there's only like one case report of a benign polyp that had HMGA2 amplification. Now, mm-hmm. translocations and upregulation of HMGA2, as you mentioned, is common in lipomas, and they can be seen in endometrial polyps. So if you use the immunohistochemical stain, you get positive staining. You just know that it's being expressed aberrantly, but the mechanism, underlying mechanism, is not clear. It could be from a translocation or amplification. So in our study, we found more amplifications of HMGA2 than a translocation.
And another chromosomal loci that was amplified is the 6Q, and that has to do with the ESR then.
That is correct. So a subset of our polyps had that amplification as well. But and we don't know what this means with regard to why these develop, right? It's interesting when we have these studies and we say, well, this gene is amplified, or this mm-hmm. region and that region. We don't really understand the interconnections of what this means for actual tumorigenesis. Not yet, but it is an interesting thing. And what's interesting about it is that it's these molecular findings that we have do overlap with adenosarcoma, and not necessarily seen in polyps. And so really that's the connection there.
That's great. So not only morphologically, they're part of that continuum, as you mentioned, but it's intriguingly 12 years follow-up, they didn't transform or cause, maybe because they were taken out or whatever, but also molecularly, which would bring us to the question from a practical point. So the next time, thank God, I'm not going to be getting a case like this. I don't sign Joanne, but my colleagues here, what should we do? It sounds like molecular is not going to help. So what's your recommendation?
Yeah. So I do think that, you know, in general, we're learning how molecular can help us on many different levels throughout pathology. I think in this particular situation, as you said, it's not going to help because there's potentially too much overlap there. You know, I think it comes down to, you know, morphology. I think that it's easier to sometimes say, okay, this is funny. Why don't you get a follow-up sample or correlate clinically? What's going on with the patient? Are there multiple polyps in the endometrial cavity? That might make you be more concerned. Was the entire thing removed? Was it done hysteroscopically? So there's a conversation between you and the clinician with regard to for management of the patient. But, you know, I typically like to show cases, really hard cases, to my colleagues. In fact, in our study, we had one that was called an atypical polyp. It was one of the ones that had the most aberrations molecularly. We went back and looked at it, and we were like, oh, this looks a little funny, and it's maybe closer to the threshold. Patients still did fine, right? So it makes me wonder if we can, even when we diagnose low-grade adenosarcoma, that doesn't have other worrisome features like sarcomatous overgrowth or P53 overexpression, if these patients can't be managed a little bit more conservatively, particularly if the entire polyp can be removed.
And the designation that you recommend is atypical uterine polyps, and then recommend.
Yeah, we do. I think you could say a typical uterine polyp, or you can say an endometrial polyp with unusual features. Some people have used the term adenofibroma for this. If you open up certain textbooks and you look at what's been classified as adenofibroma, I think it has some overlap with what we describe as these atypical polyps. But as long as I think the wording doesn't matter as much as what you say should happen for the patient. In other words, that these don't meet the threshold for adenosarcoma, and that these tend to, behave in a benign fashion, and that these patients can just be managed clinically with follow-up. I think that's the most important thing, that comes out of this study.
Thank you, Marissa, for most informative conversation. I really enjoyed it and learned a lot.
Well, I have to tell you, this was a lot more fun than I thought it was going to be. And so I'm going to highly recommend it to all my friends if you come asking.
Excellent. Thank you. We can use this plug, and please share it. A lot of people were really pleased with the how well this has been followed and throughout the globe, which is great to us. I hear from people from Australia, from India. So if we can help the young residents in countries where they don't have access to such superstars like yourself, I think that's we've done a lot. So I really appreciate your support and your taking the time.
Definitely. This is a fabulous forum. I'm happy to support it. And
thank you. Thank you for everything you do for USCAP and Modern Path. Appreciate
it. My pleasure.
Have a great day.
Thank you so much.
Any opinions expressed in this podcast are the speaker's own and do not represent the views of Modern Pathology, Springer Nature, UAB, or USCAP. Your ModPath Chat host and scientific director is Dr. George Netto. Producers are Christina Crow, Amber Jackson, Dr. Sarah Jang, and Dr. Catherine Ketchum. Technical direction is provided by Kaminsky Productions, music by Mitch Neubauer. Thanks to the authors, reviewers, and editors of Modern Pathology for making this podcast possible.